I mean, you just have to pause and really sit with that for a minute. Think about what that means. Think about how confident they must have been that this deceitful narrative would fall on friendly ears. Right? And the worst part of all that is that they were right.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org.
In this episode, we're going to be having a conversation with Andrew Seidel. He's a constitutional attorney, vice president of strategic communications for Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and author of the book American Crusade: How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. And that's what we'll be primarily talking about. And there is so much to talk about. We run out of time even getting close to looking at all the cases that he examines in this really important book. So I hope you enjoy this conversation and find it informative and pick up his book, American Crusade. But before we jump into it, we often write about these topics at our award-winning email newsletter, A Public Witness. So you really should subscribe, learn more, start reading, and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. Now here's my conversation with Andrew Seidel on American Crusade. Well, Andrew, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me on, Brian. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have you here to talk about your latest book, American Crusade: How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. And I guess we should start with that premise. You're suggesting that the Supreme Court is like dangerous?
A little bit, yes. I mean, especially when it comes to religious freedom, I think they are.
And we should know, I'm making a little bit of joke. I mean, your book, you actually wrote it, and there's a little note that it was like heading off to press before the Dobbs case, which, you know, probably adds to the timeliness of your book, and yet you weren't addressing that in here. But obviously, we live in an age where the court has become pretty significant.
It is. I mean, and this is something that the publisher and I really struggled with and went back and forth on. We're like really trying to time the publication, and they wanted to finalize the text at the end of April, and I was like, that's kind of a terrible idea because, you know, we're expecting all these decisions. But if it was one of those things where if we didn't do it, then it was going to be delayed longer than otherwise. So what we have is we have an update on my website, andrewlseidel.com, that's got, and that we're going to continue to update until the next printing. So people can go read that part for free. But yeah, I mean, until then, if we would have waited, we could have waited for forever because, as you said, the court is moving so fast. They're doing so much. There's no good time to do this. So the book was always going to need an update.
Well, let's set the stage. We'll talk about a few of the cases that you write about. You write about quite a few of them. And I really encourage people to pick up the book because it's really helpful to see just the breadth of what's going on. But let's set the stage first, because you do that in the book as well, as to how we got here. Because, you know, this didn't happen in a vacuum. We didn't just suddenly have a Supreme Court that's, you know, making all these decisions on issues of religion and religious liberty. So what happened?
So, I mean, religious freedom has long been this shield, right? It's been this hallowed protection that we have against government overreach, the minority's protection against the tyranny of the majority. And it's a right that has been guaranteed by a strong separation of church and state. And as importantly, it was religious freedom was this right that we possessed equally, right? Everybody had the same amount of religious freedom, kind of. You know, I always thought of it as embodied in those words that are etched into the edifice of the Supreme Court: equal justice under law. But not anymore, right? That's not what we have anymore. And the reason we don't have it is because there is a well-funded and powerful network of Christian nationalist organizations and judges. You know, we call it the billion-dollar shadow network at Americans United. And this shadow network is working to weaponize the First Amendment, that they are actively seeking to turn that protection of religious freedom that's enjoyed by all of us into a weapon of supremacy and privilege for the few. And so in the book, I call this network of faithful and well-funded activist groups, I call them crusaders. And together with the conservative justices on the Supreme Court, they've been waging this crusade to weaponize religious freedom. And, you know, it's not a war of conquest, not of land, but they are looking to conquer our Constitution and to remake it in their image. They're setting out to make America a Christian nation and warping religious freedom as an attempt to bring us all under their yoke, under their rule.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some ways it seems odd. I think particularly if people haven't followed all of this politicking over decades, that the Supreme Court has such a heavy place in our political imagination. I mean, you know, I've been watching Mike Pence. He spoke recently at a couple of different church services. And, you know, he seems to be, you know, trying to think that Republican voters might go from yelling "Hang Mike Pence" to voting for him. And I don't think the evangelical churches are going to turn for him. But the one moment where they really get excited, you know, there's polite applause or even silence as he talks about January 6th. But when he mentions the three Supreme Court justices, mm-hmm. right, standing ovations at, you know, First Baptist in Dallas and at John Hagee's church, Cornerstone in San Antonio in recent weeks, you know, it seems odd. Like, of all of the policies and all of the parts of government and presidency and Congress, that, like, the Supreme Court has become the focus of attention for a political movement.
It seems odd on its face, but I think when you think about it and when you look back at the way Christian nationalists and the formerly the religious right, formerly the moral majority, you know, have lost what they like to call the culture wars. I personally kind of don't like that phrase because, you know, we're talking about basic human rights in many instances when we're talking about the culture wars. They lose repeatedly when it comes to that. They cannot convince a majority of Americans on any of their issues. And you know, even the ones that where they seem to have a lock, like take marriage equality, for instance, the public opinion shifted pretty rapidly on that when the LGBTQ movement set it as a goal. They cannot win unless they can enshrine minority rule in some way in our system. And our political system has a lot of things that favor minority rule, in fact. The Electoral College, the U.S. Senate would be another one. I mean, there's a lot of pieces, mechanisms in place that already skew that way. But the clearest, most obvious one is the U.S. Supreme Court. Because you can capture this court, which is beholden to no political group out there, right? They do not answer to we the people in any way, shape, or fashion once they are in place. Once they hold office, they are there for life unless they are impeached. And we've seen what a weak check impeachment is. So setting their sights on capturing this body was brilliant, really. And that is what they did. They set out to instigate this hostile takeover of the highest court in the land. And they really did succeed. I mean, they set out to do this deliberately, systematically, and methodically. And we know how they did it. And now we are paying the price.
I mean, I think that's really important what you're just saying there about Christian nationalism is inherently anti-democratic,
yes.
Anti-democracy, small d democratic, and especially then in a pluralistic society where they don't have the votes. And so that's why we have a system where you have a president who lost the popular vote, mm-hmm. and members of his party in the Senate who represented less than a majority of Americans, but yet had a majority of the Senate, were able to not only appoint a third of the United States Supreme Court in 4 years, but they did so by stealing one of the seats from the nation's first Black president. I mean, you know, it really is a pretty remarkable moment that has occurred. And like you said, you know, we're paying the prices. I mean, you know, the Dobbs decision was a 5-4 decision. Mm-hmm. Those three justices, including the one that was stolen, that made the entire difference in that decision. And, you know, one of the things that's important about your work and a number of others who have helped documented this is that this, again, this wasn't an accident. This is very intentional, decades-long, billions of dollars of lobbying effort that paid off.
Absolutely. I mean, and we know how much money they spent on this. And I think we should definitely get into Leonard Leo and what he did here at some point. It's also, it's key to understanding American Crusade, the book too, because what the court is doing in terms of These justices were put in place to enshrine minority rule, and now by weaponizing religious freedom, they are giving back a literal weapon to do that. So when I say they are weaponizing religious freedom, I do mean that. They are litigating the legal meaning of religious freedom as a constitutional right in case after case. And in the process, they are redefining that protection. They're perverting its meaning. And the Crusaders' religious freedom challenges, their court cases, they're superficially about Christian crosses and veterans or playgrounds and skin knees or private school vouchers or bakeries and gay weddings or coaches that just want to pray. But really, what they are about is privilege and supremacy. Literally about privileging the you know, quote unquote, right kind of conservative Christian over everybody else. The goal with this push to weaponize religious freedom is to elevate conservative Christianity above the law, right? Again, and with, tying back to why they captured the court, their power and privilege have been waning for years, right? Dwindling in the face of equality, dwindling in the face of demographic change, and they are looking for a weapon to reclaim that lost status, their waning status as the dominant caste in society, to entrench their lost privilege and supremacy. And religious freedom is becoming that weapon because the crusade is succeeding. So what I set out to do in the book is tell the story of this decades-long campaign to forge the weapon. But you can't do that without also talking about the fact that they captured the court, because they had to do that first.
Yeah, you're talking about this idea of weaponizing religion. And I love the way that you set this up early in the book with a biblical metaphor. The book of Isaiah tells of a time when people shall beat their swords into plowshares. Repurposing weapons of war into implements of production, security, and stability is a lovely sentiment, but American Christians are proving the prophecy false. They're beating plowshares into swords. In particular, they're beating religious freedom into a sword, turning a hallowed tool that protected conscience from government outreach, more of a shield than a farm implement, into a weapon. I like what you're doing there, but I also think it's really important in thinking about what is religious liberty. And so I want to make sure that we're very clear as we're talking about this and this idea of it as a shield as opposed to a sword.
Yeah, I mean, this is crucial to me because that sort of bait and switch, that reforging of this principle lies at the heart of the crusade. And I mean, one of the things I really wanted to do in the book was simplify this concept and simplify this principle, because I think a lot of times, especially when you start to talk about court cases and the law, and especially when lawyers do it, we are very guilty of this. we can blind people, right? Like we build up legalese and civil procedure and judicial philosophies and levels of scrutiny and precedents, and I think sometimes we hide behind them, and I think it's often much better to just shed all of those trappings and to get back to basics, you know, to kind of cut through the BS, as it were. So it's one of the things I tried to do in the book, and I tried to boil our understanding of religious freedom that we've had in this country for centuries down to three basic lines that really make it as simple as I possibly could for everybody, you know. And then I creatively labeled them in the idea of shunning legalese: lines number one, line number two, and line number three. So, you know, I got real creative with those. That's what I mean about shunning jargon, right? And when you do that, when you boil it down, it's very easy to understand. And when you apply those lines then to the cases that we've seen the Supreme Court just botching, destroying, you know, deciding backwards, it becomes so obvious what they got wrong and how badly they got things wrong. So I thought that was really important to do for readers, so that you don't have to be a lawyer to pick this up. You don't even have to understand the law or our court systems to pick this up. Anybody can pick up this book and understand the threat that we face.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And that's really important. This is an important book for that reason, because these are important issues. So before we jump into maybe a couple of cases, you said that we needed to talk about Leo. So let's do it. I wanted to get away from that. So,
yeah. So, I mean, Leonard Leo is sort of, for those of us in the know, he's universally recognized as the man who orchestrated the hostile takeover of the Supreme Court. You may have heard of him, if you're out there listening, as the guy behind the Federalist Society. Here's how one former employee described Leonard Leo's mission. quote, he figured out 20 years ago that conservatives had lost the culture war. Abortion, gay rights, contraception. Conservatives didn't have a chance if public opinion prevailed, so they needed to stack the courts. Right? So this is exactly what we were talking about. And that's what they did. And again, notice the anti-democratic admission and goal that is inherent in that quote. If they didn't stack the court, the majority would rule. If they didn't pack the court, democracy would work. It's a very bizarre way to approach social change. So overall, we know that Leo's groups spent, just from 2014 to 2020, spent $540 million packing the Supreme Court. That's just the Supreme Court. That doesn't include all the judges that they put on lower courts. This past summer, the news broke that Leo's new group that he created raised $1.6 billion. That is billion with a B. You did not mishear me. Which is, you know, that's $1 billion more than they spent capturing the court. And so you learn about that in the update that I mentioned that's on my website. But Leo's job was to seek out judicial nominees that could be put on the bench. He is the guy who wrote the three shortlists that Donald Trump published of judges that would be nominated to the Supreme Court when Trump had an opening. And his job was described as this, quote, the monitor of the nominees' ideological purity. Right, so he was those judges, he was responsible for monitoring their ideological purity. All told, we know that Leo is responsible for the confirmation of John Roberts, Sam Alito, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. Right, so that's five justices on the Supreme Court that he is responsible for getting confirmed. Justice Thomas is an old friend of his. All six of those justices are or were members of the Federalist Society. There's actually, I just saw the other day, there's video of Thomas and Leo joking on stage at a Federalist Society event in Texas about how Leo is the third most powerful man in America. So that's six votes on the Supreme Court, and Leo personally chose five of them for their ideology. Right? They were chosen for their ideology, and it is a crusader ideology. And I think this is really a hard thing for people to swallow and to understand. The conservative justices here are themselves crusaders. Again, chosen for their ideology. So I just want to give one example to drive this point home, because there's a man that some see, right, as more centrist, maybe more moderate than some of the other conservatives, even though he is absolutely not, which I explain in the book, John Roberts, right? So John Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, in the first Bush's Department of Justice, worked alongside Ken Starr, and he wrote briefs in that Department of Justice arguing that public schools can impose religion on children at graduation ceremonies, and that Christian Bible clubs can use the public schools to organize. And when he was in the Reagan White House, he actually supported a constitutional amendment that would allow public schools to impose Christian prayer on school children. And we have the memos for this. Roberts wrote in one of the memos, quote, "We still have an uphill battle to return prayer to schools." Right? We battle return prayer to school. That is the language of a crusader, right? So the justices themselves are highly invested in this crusade.
Yeah, which of course, you know, kind of puts the lie, the idea of just like, oh, it's just, you know, what the law says, and it's just original intent, right? I mean, these are very much, you know, political figures in a political position. And
absolutely.
It's important to treat them in that way, you know, to recognize what's happening. So let's talk about a few of the cases. Like I said, you pack a bunch in here. And so, you know, we're not going to get to all of them, which is good, because that way people have to buy the book. So
I appreciate that. Thank you, Brian.
Well, I thought I'd hit a couple of them. I mean, one of the early ones you deal with, and it's probably one that people know a lot about, is the Masterpiece Cake Shop. But I wanted to bring that one back in because it's kind of that basic idea is back at the court right now. And so that seems like a really relevant one to kind of both talk about the older case, and you can give us a little bit of the update of what's happening right now in using religious liberty as this sword against LGBTQ individuals.
Yeah, I mean, this is really a remarkable case for a whole host of reasons. And I mean, we could do, you know, we could do a deep dive on this case and do a, you know, a 4 or 5
We could do a whole
show.
Episode just talking about Masterpiece
really
Cake Shop.
I mean, you really easily could. So the first thing people need to understand is that this is not a case about a baker. It's not even a case about a bakery. This is a case that was orchestrated by the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is this Christian nationalist organization that set out to use religious freedom to undermine civil rights laws. That was the goal. They have been taking variations on cases like this for years in a whole host of states. They've been trying to gut civil rights protections and civil rights laws in the name of religious freedom for a long time. That's the first thing that people need to understand. And that is especially clear in the case that you mentioned that the Supreme Court is considering right now, which is called the 303 Creative case. Even more ridiculous than the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. I mean, this new case involves a website designer who has never designed a wedding website, but does not want to design a wedding website for a same-sex couple. And so sued over Colorado's civil rights law because she might have to do that someday, even though she's never designed a wedding website in her entire career. Completely orchestrated in the wake of the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. And would have been laughed out of court by, if it was brought by certainly a progressive group with those kind of bona fides. But the short version of the Masterpiece Cake Shop case is that Charlie Craig and Dave Mullins had been together for a couple of years when they decided to get married. And then months before their wedding, they arrive at this bakery. They want to taste some cakes and they want to design their own cakes. The owner greets them, realizes that Charlie and Dave are planning their own wedding to each other, and says, "I'm not going to sell you a wedding cake." Charlie and David never get a chance to ask for anything on the cake. They don't get to say, you know, we want a custom design, we want this. There was never a time where they got to even discuss their design. So they turned around, they left feeling humiliated, feeling hurt, feeling marginalized. Charlie's mom was with them. She kind of didn't really understand what was going on at the time. You know, they went into this store happy and came out just devastated and dehumanized. And I interviewed Charlie and David for the book, and I included a lot of that interview in the book. I was the first person to interview them since the case had been decided. I also interviewed a number of the state actors, the members of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission that were involved in this case. So Charlie and David later on, they kind of talk about this with some friends. Charlie posts something on social media about it and how it made them feel. And eventually people are like, hey, you know, that's actually illegal. In Colorado, businesses cannot discriminate against customers because they are LGBTQ. So Colorado has, as most states do, 47 of the states have a civil rights law on the books. And these are the laws that we created in the wake of Jim Crow, in the wake of segregation, to stop segregation. You know, like, I mean, we just had Martin Luther King Day, and every year for Martin Luther King Day, I read his letter from the Birmingham jail. And there's this line in there where he talks about his daughter seeing a commercial for Funtown on TV and then asking why she can't go, and seeing the clouds of inferiority forming in her mental sky because black girls aren't allowed to go to Funtown. And it is to prevent this kind of dignitary harm that we have these laws in place in the first place. And they bring this state action. They go to the Colorado Civil Rights Commission and say, this happened. Seems to us like it violates the Colorado Civil Rights Act. We'd like you to do something about it if you agree. And the Colorado Civil Rights Commission agrees and then and says, yes, the bakery violated the law. And the Alliance Defending Freedom steps in and sues and claims religious freedom. And it gets this disastrous case and it ends up at the Supreme Court. Completely, the narrative by this time, just completely tortured and warped beyond all recognition, which I think is key and one of the reasons that I'm no longer doing litigation and have moved into the communication side of things is actually this case. So it's I mean, it really was a remarkable twist that the ADF was able to pull off here. You know, you have the owner of the bakery on The View saying, I don't believe that Jesus would have made a cake if he had been a baker. Christ wouldn't make the cake. And instead of talking to the couple that was discriminated against, we're venerating this you know, poor, persecuted Christian baker because the big bad government is coming after him. And I mean, if you pause for a second to think about what that looks like in another context, I mean, then you're talking about, you know, venerating the segregationist who would deny Martin Luther King's daughter the ability to go to Funtown instead of talking to Martin Luther King and his daughter, right? And it's to me, it is one of the more remarkable cases. And we can talk about what the Supreme Court did in a second, but that's the basic story behind it.
And so, yeah, and then let's talk about what's going on with the court, because in some reason, the reason why the court's debating the issue-ish again on an even, you know, more a case that the ADF has even more control and just like creating is the court didn't really resolve the issues at hand.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't really. And first, we should say, like, the court, not this Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court in previous cases, for instance, during the 60s and 70s, did look at this question, looked at does freedom of speech, does the free exercise of religion give businesses a right to violate the Civil Rights Act? And they laughed it off. They laughed it off in footnotes. Like it was risible for previous Supreme Courts. And now this court, all of a sudden, because of the shift in personnel, is seriously entertaining and likely going to decide in favor of these questions, which is truly, truly a remarkable shift and guts civil rights protections across the board. One thing to realize is I've tried to distinguish between the baker, Jack Phillips, the person, and the bakery. And the court didn't do that. The court really acted as though this was an individual, like a guy like baking in his shop, and that, you know, this gay couple like banged on his door, was like, bake us a cake, and he refused, and how horrible. Masterpiece Cake Shop is a limited liability company organized and protected under the laws of the state of Colorado, right? Like Jack Phillips personally, if he poisoned a wedding of 500 people because he, you know, did a terrible job baking a cake, he would not have been personally liable for that. Masterpiece Cake Shop LLC would have been liable and might have gone bankrupt, but Jack Phillips would have been fine. He would have kept his house, his savings, all, you know, he was fine, because in the United States, we treat business entities different from individuals. And that actually, that distinction between a corporate entity organized under the law and an individual person is maybe one of the best inventions of the last 500 years. It's responsible for so much innovation and so much of the progress and science that we've seen. And the court just utterly ignores it here. Masterpiece Cake Shop gets to take advantage of all of these protections under the law, but then all of a sudden gets to turn around and impose its religion, the religion of its owner, on these individuals. So what the court does when it gets the question is also kind of remarkable. And they don't decide, yes, Phillips has a religious freedom right to discriminate. They don't say you get this license to discriminate. That's what ADF wanted. That's what they're arguing for in this newest case, though they're arguing only on free speech grounds. Instead, what the court did was say that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, which is, again, that state body that's in charge of enforcing the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act, that state body was hostile to Jack Phillips's religion, and therefore the entire proceeding had to be thrown out. So essentially what they did, what the Supreme Court did, was give the bakery this get out of jail free card. And to do that, they had to scapegoat two of the civil rights commissioners. And so there's these two civil rights commissioners, and they are named in the opinion and forever immortalized in, you know, Supreme Court opinions as bigots, as anti-religious bigots, as anti-Christian bigots. And these are truly, I spoke with both of them, I interviewed them for the book. These were really kind, thoughtful public servants who took this position to protect everybody's civil rights, and including religious minorities. And the idea that they are somehow bigoted as a result of the things that they said is I think it's unconscionable. I think what the Supreme Court did to them is unconscionable. I really do. And I had this remarkable moment where I was in Colorado for the book tour in December, and a gentleman got up and asked a question. And I told the story. I told the story of these civil rights, these people who fought for civil rights and what happened to them. So for instance, one of the commissioners was this guy named Raju Jairam. And Kennedy, Justice Kennedy, in his opinion, quotes one of the things that Raju Jairam said during the Civil Rights Commission's consideration of Phillips's case. And Raju Jairam was quoting from a New Mexico Supreme Court opinion. He was paraphrasing it. He didn't have it memorized off the top of his head, but he's doing what we want a thoughtful public servant to do, looking towards a legal expert and trying to go and quote and do what they've done. And by the way, the Supreme Court itself quoted that same case before. In fact, Ruth Bader Ginsburg quotes it in her Hobby Lobby dissent. That is what Justice Kennedy quotes in his majority opinion in Masterpiece Cakesop. He dishonestly edits the quote and tortures it into some kind of hostility. So you have this thoughtful public servant who's trying to do the right thing by everybody, quoting another Supreme Court in the United States, and Justice Kennedy is saying that that's hostility towards Christianity. And forever, that Raju Jairam is going to live in infamy in that Supreme Court opinion. And when I was at this book talk in December, this gentleman got up and asked the question, and it was Raju Jairam. And I was able to tell that story and then say, and the person who did that is right here. And he got a standing ovation from everybody in the room. They were cheering him on, and we got to chat after the talk. And, you know, he came up and shook my hand, and I think he said thank you to me, like, I don't know, 20 or 30 times. It was one of the more moving experiences I've ever had as a writer or a lawyer. Because as he said it, you know, he felt vindicated, at least in the eyes of some people and in some of history, because now at least his story is out there, even if it's, my book's not going to be as widely read as that Supreme Court opinion, but some people.
Well, you're on Dangerous Dogma, so it will be now.
There we go.
If only the two of us had that influence.
Someday. We'll conquer the world someday, Brad.
But I mean, I appreciate what you're doing there is noting, you know, this is real world stuff that impacts real world people. And these are important cases. They're not just, oh, you know, nine people said this. It really does make a difference. And that's true throughout the book.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
And I also think it's important to note that, you know, it's not just merely that religious liberty is being redefined. It's not being applied evenly as a standard. This really is Christian nationalism. This really is that conservative Christians win and others don't even win when the same standard could have been applied. So, like, yes, you know, you have this of, you know, let's just say, like, even if Kennedy was right and they really had said bigoted things, the standard here was, okay, you automatically win because the other side said these things that showed religious bigotry. But then when you take the Muslim ban that you write about in another chapter, where it's very clear, not only is the ban itself based on religious discrimination, but Trump said the quiet part very out loud.
Very out loud.
And then, like, suddenly now it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that he said what it was all about. That gets tossed.
To me, that was really remarkable. And I did try to highlight that in the book because the Muslim ban was decided in close proximity to the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. You know, I mean, we're talking weeks, you know, months apart. And in the Muslim ban case, you have clear, genuine hostility directed at a minority that the court improperly upheld. And in the bakery case, you have hostility that was manufactured by the court, supposedly directed against a member of the majority religion in the country, and then improperly struck down. So, you know, we had this abuse of this idea of hostility to advance the crusade. And it really is religious freedom for me and not for thee. But again, that is the purpose of the weapon in the first place. It is to elevate these Christian nationalists, these deeply conservative Christians who affiliate with one party, over everybody else, to make them into this special favored class and to make us second class citizens. And lest people think that it's just you and I here opining on this and kind of, you know, having this one anecdote to point to, we have stats. Studies have crunched these numbers and backed them up. So before the courts were packed, the court ruled in favor of religion generally about half the time. And that, I mean, that's what you would expect, right? Like, you know, about half the time, this court's going to come out this way. But under the Roberts Court, one study found that win rate jumped to 81%. Okay. And to more to the point, this is not a pro-religion shift, but a pro-Christian shift. So in the early courts, mainstream Christianity won in about 44% of the cases. And under Roberts, that nearly doubled up to 85% of the cases. And it's important to note that those numbers don't include the most recent term, which was just a banner term for Christian nationalists. So religious freedom really has become a weapon of Christian privilege.
Well, I do want to talk about one other kind of set of cases that you talk about in the chapters. And like I said, we're not even covering, you know, I don't know, not even a sixth or so of the chapters here. So there's a lot more cases, but this is on my mind because we get done here a little bit. And before this episode comes out, obviously this will happen, but in about an hour after we get done, I'm heading over to the Missouri State Capitol to testify for like the third year on bills related to exemptions for houses of worship to health, mm-hmm. public health laws. And you've got a chapter on the COVID cases, religious freedom is killing us. So, you know, this is, I think, has been a really important issue. And we saw the impact of the shift even as Justice Barrett came on the court when suddenly the rules completely changed. And so what happened in COVID in redefining religious liberty?
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the more remarkable chapters to write. First of all, because we were going through the pandemic, as I'm writing it, and I'm, you're watching this happen in real time. As Barrett came onto the court as I was writing, and I was going back and forth with a number of scholars as we were watching these COVID cases go through the court, right? And you have all these challenges that are being brought by Christian nationalists to these public health measures that are meant to protect everybody and to save lives and to prevent the spread of a lethal virus and to keep the pressure off of our, you know, like deeply embattled medical system that's hanging by a thread in many cases. And all these challenges are being brought and they're barely being held off at the Supreme Court. I mean, barely being held off at the Supreme Court. And that's remarkable in and itself because there's precedent on this issue going back over 100 years. And this is one of the lines I mentioned earlier. You know, I draw three basic lines to try to describe religious freedom. And one of those lines is that your religious freedom is not and has never been a license to harm anybody else or to violate their rights in any way, shape, or form. And that includes by spreading a lethal virus around to the rest of society, right? You don't have a right to do that just because you believe X. That's not something that's ever happened. Supreme Court addressed that specifically a number of times in a number of cases over the years. And still, barely, because of John Roberts, we were seeing these cases against these public health measures, like barely upholding the public health measures. And then you have this shift that happens, and it happens literally overnight. I mean, it's because Amy Coney Barrett is put on the court that all of a sudden things change. All of a sudden, this rule that existed for hundreds of years disappeared, and now. And this happened. The decision came down on the right around Thanksgiving, like almost at midnight. Like it was a midnight opinion that when this came down, and Amy Coney Barrett taking the place of Ruth Bader Ginsburg provides the deciding vote that changes the law, that all of a sudden says that 100 years of this not being a right has now changed. It was truly a remarkable moment, and it really brought home the fact that a change in personnel on the high court can change your rights. And that's exactly what we're not supposed to have. But that is in fact what our Supreme Court is. Trump's reception of Barrett at the White House actually ended up becoming a super spreader event. You know, I mean, a few people don't remember this, but the court had twice refused churches' attempts to declare themselves immune from these public health measures before, again, because of Roberts. But then the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the imposition of Barrett, all of a sudden tips this balance. And I think one of the more remarkable things that is really worth highlighting is that the Supreme Court made this just monumental change in 15 paragraphs. Like one of the shortest opinions I've ever seen. It was just this tiny, like barely thing. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the shadow docket cases. And it came during one of the worst outbreaks that we had seen in COVID, or worst waves of COVID that we had seen at that time. So it was really remarkable. And the facts of the case are so disingenuous and just undercut the opinion completely.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's worth highlighting. I mean, in so many of these cases, and we don't really have time to get into the Bremerton case, which may be like the worst example of this.
Yeah.
But like the facts that are claimed by the people who are claiming to be the Christian litigants here, they flat out lie so yes. often. I mean, like in Bremerton, it's just a quiet, silent prayer. And you know, something crazy has happened when a justice, in this case, Sotomayor, like literally puts photos in the opinion, because that's unusual. They're like, this is not a private prayer. This is not a quiet prayer. And I mean, you made a comment about how you left litigation and focused more on the comms side. I mean, it's amazing what they've been able to get away with by lying about the facts of the case to get yes. these rulings.
It really is. And it's worth highlighting that dishonesty. I'm glad you're doing it. And this is a through line that I draw in the cases. I think you're right that Bremerton sort of is the pinnacle, the praying football coach case that people may be familiar with. But we saw hints of this before. So there's this really important case called Trinity Lutheran versus Comer out of Missouri, which ended up essentially funding a children's ministry with taxpayer dollars, where both sides agreed on the outcome of the case. And our legal system is adversarial. It depends on two sides disagreeing and fighting it out in court. If you agree, there's no case. And the Supreme Court decides it anyway. And those parties agreed that there was no separation of church and state issue with the government taxing citizens and then turn around and giving that money to a children's ministry. So we're not going to even address any possible church-state issue. Like, you don't get to just agree that there's not a constitutional violation. And then like it was mind-blowing to see this. But really, you're right. I think the Kennedy versus Bremerton case, and I'm going to dive into it for a second because I'm a lawyer. And one of the things that lawyers take pretty seriously is we have a duty of what's called honesty to the tribunal, right? This means that like, even if you're researching a case and you find a case that's like not good for your client, you actually still have a duty. You have a duty to your client, but you also have a duty to the court to let the court know that there's this case that is on point and against your side, right? I mean, you do that obviously in as creative ways as you can, but you have a duty to be honest. And the Ninth Circuit, in the case of Joe Kennedy, this football coach who was imposing prayer on other people's children, the Ninth Circuit warned that the Christian nationalist law firm on the other side of this, which was First Liberty, that First Liberty Institute was spinning a, quote, false and a, quote, deceitful narrative in the case. All right, so the three-judge panel explained that, quote, the facts in the record utterly belie the contention that the prayer was personal and private. And then, in an en banc opinion, which means all the judges on the Ninth Circuit considered it, one appeals judge actually hammered another appeals judge for buying into the lies And this is just a remarkable quote. It's worth hearing in full. So here's what the judge wrote. Unlike Odysseus, who was able to resist the seductive song of the sirens by being tied to a mast and having his shipmates stop their ears with beeswax, our colleague Judge O'Scanlan appears to have succumbed to the siren song of a deceitful narrative of this case spun by counsel for the appellant to the effect that this coach was disciplined for holding silent private prayers. That narrative is false. The judge goes on to say that the reader should know the following basic truth. Kennedy was never disciplined for offering silent private prayers. And then, and I've never seen this, the judge compares the deceitful narrative's, quote, unmoored claims side by side with reality in a chart. I've just never seen something like that in a federal opinion. And then another judge says the actual record presented in the district court bears little resemblance to the hypothetical scenarios posited by the coach. Right? Like, you're not a lawyer, but you're a good, moral, upstanding person. But like, if a federal judge said this about my litigation and like my claims that I had made to the court, I would go hide my head in shame, right? Like, I would take a sabbatical. I would question what I was doing with my life. Maybe I would read up on some moral philosophy, like, you know, maybe take some ethics courses. And instead, the First Liberty Institute appealed to the Supreme Court. After being called out for a false narrative, for deceit by federal judges, they repeated that false and deceitful narrative to the justices. I mean, you just have to pause and really sit with that for a minute. Think about what that means. Think about how confident they must have been that this deceitful narrative would fall on friendly ears. And the worst part of all that is that they were right.
So this is a perfect segue case, actually. I'm glad we actually ended up talking about it as we get to the end of our time here, because I wanted to give you a chance to talk about what you are doing. You've kind of hinted at it that you're not an attorney, and the organization that argued for the school district in the Bremerton case was Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And I'll note as full disclosure that I am on the board. And you work there. So why don't you tell us a little bit about AU and what you all are doing and what you are doing there at AU?
Yeah, I'm thrilled to have joined Americans United. I really am. My official fancy new title is Vice President of Strategic Communications. And, I run the comms shop. It's new to have a lawyer in that role. It's proven, I think, pretty useful and successful over the almost year that I've been in that role. And Americans United for Separation of Church and State is a nonpartisan, not-for-profit, educational and advocacy organization. And we work to bring together people of all religions and none to protect the right of everybody to believe as they want and to stop anybody from using their beliefs to harm others. And so we take this fight into the courts, into the state legislatures, and then into the public square. And really what we are fighting for is freedom without favor and equality without exception. And this fight has been going on for nearly 75 years. AU has been the preeminent organization working to ensure that church-state separation remains that shield that really protects religious freedom for all of us. And I truly believe, and this is one of the reasons that I came to AU, that we are only going to be successful in this fight. We can only do what we are trying to do as Americans United. And that, so I'm proud to be a part of an organization that embodies that value in its very name, and just thrilled to be part of this fight and this amazing team.
Well, on that note, I mean, you know, it's funny, we set up this time to talk and then happened to meet each other in person last week at the point that we're recording last week in Missouri. So what's the latest news? What's AU doing in Missouri?
This is really exciting. AU has taken a trailblazing, groundbreaking lawsuit in Missouri. We are challenging Missouri's abortion bans as a violation of the separation of church and state. So with our partners at the National Women's Law Center, with the Arnold and Porter Law Firm, we have 13 different clergy representing 6 different denominations who are challenging the abortion bans in Missouri as a violation of the separation of church and state. This is not an argument that has been made or tried in the courts before, right? We've We didn't need it before. We had Roe versus Wade. We had the right. And one of the things that Missouri legislature did when it was passing this abortion ban was told us that they were trying to impose their narrow religious doctrine on everybody else in the state. Right? They wrote Almighty God is the author of life into the law. They talked about being from the biblical side of it. They cited Psalms 119 instead of Psalm 119, but we'll forgive them that, I guess, maybe. They talked about God not giving them a choice when they were passing this law, right? They were very clear about what they were trying to do. And it didn't have anything to do with the health of the mother or any of these other millions of things they could have relied on or that this could be. They were trying to impose their religion on everybody. And that is just a gross abuse of power. It's prevented by the Missouri Constitution, and we are going to sue and vindicate that right under the Missouri Constitution. So I'm excited about this lawsuit. We launched it last Thursday on January 19th. It was you and I think we both had a lot of fun while we were there. It was in the cathedral downtown. All the clergy were there. There was a ton of media there. We marched, we sang, and it ended up being Reverend Blackman's birthday. We sang her happy birthday at the end of it.
People can find more at AU.org about all the different cases we've talked, about, like Primerton, but the Missouri case. And it really is remarkable, the video and some of the materials you put together on the suit, where you can see the lawmakers say the quiet part out loud. As I was reading through the lawsuit, I mean, I've testified, I don't know, more than a dozen times in the state legislature here on church state issues. And I was like, oh, I recognize this name and this name. And a lot of my sparring partners in some of these hearings, are right there in it, quoted in the lawsuit. But people can find a lot of resources there. And then, of course, I encourage people to check out your book, American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. Andrew, thanks for all the work you're doing and for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian. It was a lot of fun. Next time, I'll try to let you get a word in edgewise.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.